Good evening, everybody. Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio. It's September 9th, 2011 here at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We have an awesome show for you here today. Normally, we open up the show with a look at the news, all of which is available at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. However, Carl Stern, our newsman, is not here today. Carl Stern had his day in court. Of course, Carl's a cop, has his day in court all the time, but unavailable for the show today. However, fear not. We have an awesome program here for you today. It's not every day you get to interview somebody who just a couple of days ago, actually, was on the History Channel. History Channel special that basically took a look at her New York Times best-selling book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Leslie Kane is on the show today, and I'm very excited. One of the biggest guests we have ever had on this program. This book, I got it for the Kindle. It's awesome. Just came out in paperback a while ago, available on the Kindle, Amazon.com. I'm sure the Nook as well and everything else. This book, I've read a lot of books about UFOs. You read a lot of stories about UFOs. You read a lot of accounts about things that happen. And often the stories involve witnesses who refuse to go on the record. Sometimes they're just your average person. Sometimes they're a government official. But these people don't want their names out there. That is not this book. UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. In this book, Leslie writes about half the book. The other half of the book is written by these individuals who are going on the record. There are statements here. There are articles written by individuals who have been in aircraft that have shot at UFOs. They've been scrambled to chase after UFOs. They've been told to shoot at the UFOs, take them down. And their reports are in this book. These people are all named. There are governors that go on the record talking about craft that they saw. The book is amazing. UFOs, pilots, government officials, generals go on the record. Leslie Kane is going to be our guest here in just a moment. Wanted to make sure we got some information out here as well. The website, AfterDarkRadioShow.com, it is back. As a lot of people are aware, we took some time off during the summer. A lot of stuff came up this summer, but we are back. Been back for a couple of weeks now, and we got some big guests lined up. Some really big guests lined up. And you can follow it all at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We're also up now on Facebook, Facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow. Go up there, click the like button, see how many people we can get liking the show. And of course, if you've got stories, if you've got some interesting things you dig up on the internet, please send them to me. Please post them on the Facebook page. Good stuff will go up on the main website. And if you're a first-time listener, a lot of good stuff up on the website besides the news stories. All of the shows that we have ever done are up on the website right now for free. They're all free downloads. Just head up to AfterDarkRadioShow.com, and you can go into the area there that says past shows and scroll down, and tons of stuff here. Tons of different shows. We've talked pretty much everything, the MJ-12 documents, JFK, theories of time. Carl and I visited the Georgia Guidestones. We have a lot of talk about that. Nicholas De Leon talked technology, cutting-edge technology. That was an awesome show. We've talked the Illuminati. And, of course, Dr. Jeff Meldrum, PhD, Scientific Evidence for the Existence of Bigfoot. All of these shows are up right now for free. Go check them out, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. If you love the show, just spread the word. Pretty much doing it for free right now, trying to get the word out. So hopefully check it out, like the Facebook page, listen to the shows, spread the word around, and let's get some people. Let's boost the numbers. We got a lot of people listening right now. I'm stunned by the number of listeners we have already, but there can always be more. So check it out, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. And as noted, in just a moment, we are going to be joined by Leslie Kane, the author of UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record, available at Amazon.com for the Kindle. Bookstores everywhere, just out on paperback on August 2nd. It's going to be an awesome show. We'll be right back with that. You're listening to After Dark Radio at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, joined today by Leslie Kane. Very happy to have Leslie on the show today. I've been reading her book, which, of course, you can check out at Amazon.com. UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. It's actually an awesome book. We're going to talk about it through most of the show today. She was just on the History Channel August 25th, a special that actually looked at a lot of the cases from this book. Very happy to have Leslie on the show today. One of the only people I learned before we have gone on the air here that still has an ix.netcom.com address from about 1995. Leslie, how are you doing today?
Doing well, Brian. Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Now, let's talk about the book here, because a lot of people, one of the great things about this book is you often hear these stories about UFOs, and really a lot of different things, and the reports will be, well, you know, we talked to so-and-so, but they can't go on the record, and obviously this book, everybody in this book is on the record, and we're talking five-star generals, we're talking, I mean, the whole gamut here is not really even interviewed in this book. They write their own stories about what happened, and it's a fascinating book, and New York Times bestseller, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah, it was on the New York Times list for 3 weeks, so that was a surprise last summer when it first came out. Yeah, and I think the point you made is really, really important, Brian, because I think the reason this book has done so well is because, as you mentioned, it includes these very, very high-level sources, all of them on the record, and cases that are extremely well-documented. I mean, you can't argue with the evidence that we have for these very exceptional cases. And the point you also made is that what I've done is invited these very exceptional people, among them five generals and a former U.S. governor and John Podesta writing the foreword and lots of very fascinating people. I asked them to write their own chapters for the book rather than have me just quoting them, which is what journalists usually do. You know, they do their interviews. They might even include a transcription of an interview. But what I wanted these folks to do was actually help me write the book so that when the reader is learning about UFOs, they're not just hearing it from me, they actually get to read, you know, directly from the people involved and in their own words. And everybody is their own person and has their own personality and their own writing style. And I really wanted to preserve the unique qualities of each person and have them be as personal as they could about what happened to them and let people, you know, read it in their own words. And I think that's a lot of what makes the book really interesting. I don't claim full responsibility for the success of this book. A lot of it goes to these other people that contributed to it.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about you, because a lot of books that you see written about UFOs are, you know, they are people that are in, I guess, the UFO industry. I don't know the best term to use here, but you are actually an investigative journalist, like a mainstream investigative journalist, and this whole story kind of fell into your lap. And tell everybody a little bit about how that happened, and obviously the qualms that you had when the time came to decide whether or not you were going to really go public with all of this.
Okay, yeah, and it's as you said, it was completely unexpected. I was, as you said, a reporter, an investigative reporter with a track record. I'd done a lot of freelance writing and also working in radio, and I was working at the time that this all began at a public radio station in the San Francisco Bay Area, co-producing and co-hosting a daily investigative news program. And suddenly I received in the mail from a colleague in France an extraordinary report that was written by former military officials in France about UFOs. And among the people that wrote this report were a four-star general, similar to the people who have contributed to my book, really. It was a bunch of generals. There was an admiral in this group. There was a former chief of police and also the former head of the French National Space Studies Center, which is the equivalent of our NASA. So it was a very distinguished group of people that had spent 3 years studying the UFO data of some of these, you know, really exceptional cases, because they were concerned about the question of UFOs and defense. You know, was there a national security issue involved here? That was actually the title of their study, was UFOs and defense. So anyway, what really fascinated me about the study was not just the cases that they put forward, but their conclusion, and this is what really got me going as a journalist. This distinguished group of people from France concluded, and again, you have to look at the cases first, which are all included in the report, but they concluded, and they put this in their report in black and white, that the best explanation they could come up with for these cases was what they called the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And they said this was the most valid, the most rational, and the most likely explanation for these very exceptional cases that are so well documented that we can't explain them, you know, through man-made means. And so I was very struck as a journalist to see people of this caliber coming out with a statement saying it's likely that there are extraterrestrial objects in our skies. I thought that was a huge story at the time. And I think, you know, it is a huge story. I still feel that way. So that's when how I began the whole process. I never anticipated this would happen. And I was, as you mentioned, I had a lot of qualms about it. I decided when I received this report from France that I wanted to do a story about it because I had done a lot of freelance publishing before. And one of the places I published a lot of stories is in the Boston Globe. So I pitched a story to my editor there who I'd worked with before on numerous occasions. And she had a lot of trepidation about it, but she eventually agreed to publish a story that I wrote based on this report from France. And I was very, very nervous about it. The ridicule factor was, I think, a lot stronger then than it is now. I didn't tell my colleagues at the radio station that I was even interested in the subject until that story was published in May of 2000. That was the big turning point for me. Once the Boston Globe published it, then I felt, okay, I've crossed a barrier here and I can be public about it. But I was very nervous about it prior to publishing that article.
Now, the reason, this is kind of interesting that you mentioned that, because in the book, there's a couple of chapters, actually, on the Phoenix Lights and Fife Symington, who was the governor. And, you know, obviously, when this whole thing was going down, he had to make a decision because he actually saw the craft. You know, he saw it with his own eyes. And what happened, you know, and everybody, it took like 2 months for the story to get out and you know, people were calling him and this and that. He had to make a decision about what to do. And he ended up calling a press conference. And I don't want to say that he made a mockery of the situation. I know a lot of people probably would have said that. But he felt he needed to bring some levity to this. He needed to calm people down. He needed to get people to relax. And so he trotted out a man dressed as an alien and said that this is his, you know, this is the man responsible. This is the person responsible. Or the whole story. But, you know, he had a lot of stuff that was on his mind. You know, can I go forward with this? What are people going to say? Am I going to be ridiculed? And in the end, he decided he wasn't going to say anything until long after he was out of office. And I guess if you had heard this story and talked to Fife Symington and investigated that, do you think you would have made a different decision at the time about going public with that story?
You mean if I had met him back then?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea. I mean, I think he was so, I mean, the way he's expressed it to me, he was so concerned about the ridicule issue and that he wouldn't even be able to do his job as governor, and you know, which is to manage the whole state of Arizona, if he even said that he had seen something. I mean, it is astonishing to imagine this, but even though he saw the thing on the night that lots of other people did, as you said, he didn't feel he could talk about it, and I just think, I don't know what would have happened if, you know, a lot of this stuff had come out sooner, and he felt, you know, but it was 1997. I think if something like this happened today, there's a good chance that a governor or an elected official would talk about it. I really think things have changed a lot since 1997, but, you know, he just made that decision. And I think the point you made about the mockery, yes, a lot of people in Arizona really did feel that he was making fun of them. I mean, witnesses were very offended and insulted by what he did. And rightly so, and he acknowledges that. I think what's really interesting about his story is how he has come full circle and 10 years later, you know, really wants to make amends to the people in Arizona, make amends to his constituents who he understands now were very upset by this. And now he's an advocate for changing government policy. So it's a very interesting story of a man that's gone through a lot of change. But the biggest factor is that, of course, he's no longer in politics. So he feels freer to talk about this than he did then.
Do you feel like you kind of related to him better in the sense that when you two discussed this, you know, you had a mainstream career and you had to make this same decision. And so, you know, a lot of people that saw the press conference and saw what happened, you know, they were very angry. And was it sort of something where you kind of felt that, you know, I dealt with this and I understand what he was feeling and, you know, he understands that I had to go through the same thing. And so we kind of had that connection there?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, but I really think there's a big difference between a journalist doing this and an elected official. I mean,
well, sure.
Governor of a state, you know, he's got a lot more at risk, and he's going to be attacked a lot more severely than I would have been as a journalist. So I think that, you know, it's really hard to make the comparison. I mean, I know that Arizona, it's a lot of vicious politics in that state. There is a lot of vicious, you know, media attacking, and, you know, it was proven by Frances Barwood, who was the city councilwoman who did go public about her desire to investigate this sighting. She was actually crucified. She was just, you know, insulted by the media through cartoons that made fun of her and everything. So I don't know. I think it's really hard to compare the risk that I felt to the risk that he would have, that he felt at the time. I think his risk was much greater than mine was.
Now, you mentioned that if something like this happened today, let's just say that the Phoenix Lights, same thing happened again tonight, mm-hmm. and everybody saw it, and you had an elective official that saw it. You believe that today that person would go forward and talk about it as opposed to, I guess, making the decision that Fife Symington made. Now, do you feel that there was a turning point? You mentioned, obviously, things being different now than in 1997. Was there a turning point? Do you think there was something that occurred? Was there a movie that came out? I mean, was there something that happened that you feel was kind of a turning point, or was it just the passing of time?
Good question. That's a very interesting thing to think about. I mean, in my experience, I think it's been a more gradual shift. I mean, because since I started this in about 2000, as I mentioned, I published my first story, I jumped into this and published a whole series of articles and just became very involved in this as a journalist. I actually was able to observe, you know, the climate changing. Now, I like to think that I may have had something to do with that, but I'm just one person, so I think there's a lot more factors to it, but I can't really put my finger on any one event. I know that the O'Hare incident in 2006, though, got a huge amount of media and a lot of hits on the Chicago Tribune website. I mean, I think that also with the internet being so much more a part of people's lives now than it was in 97, I think that things just happen really fast and there's a lot more coverage that things get because of the internet. So, you know, the internet wasn't nearly as big a deal in 10 years ago as it is now. So I think that's played a huge role in, you know, drawing more attention to this, and there's just sort of been a gradual climate of change as more and more serious people have come forward about this, you know, and their voices are heard more in the media now. So I just think there's been a gradual change. I mean, I don't know for sure if this were to happen again, if the governor of a state would acknowledge having seen it, but I think it would be much harder for the subject to be avoided than it was then. I mean, with all you can imagine if there was a massive sighting now where 1,000 people see something hanging out over a big city in America, I think it would have a huge effect and get a lot more coverage and acknowledgement than it did in 97. It's hard to imagine it wouldn't. And with everybody with their cameras now, you know, I'm sure there would be a lot of pictures too. And we didn't have that in with the Phoenix Lights. People didn't have their digital gear on them all the time. So there's a big difference now.
You know, what's interesting about the Chicago Tribune story that you mentioned is I also cover pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. Very, very fringe sort of deal, much like, you know, covering UFOs and that sort of thing. And it's interesting because it's a very fringe sort of deal, and a lot of people don't like to talk about watching it and that sort of thing. But, you know, every now and then I'll hear from somebody in a mainstream news outlet that will write a story about pro wrestling, and they'll just be like, man, this got more hits for this story than anything we've done in months. The Chicago Tribune story, you know, this was about UFOs, and it got, I believe, the most hits of any article ever on that website.
That's absolutely correct. Over 1 million hits, and it was the biggest, more hits than anything they'd ever done before in the history of the newspaper.
It's just amazing when you think about these things, and, you know, there are a lot of things that people don't like to talk about, and I don't want to mention this, but, you know, there are a lot of people that are interested in this subject. And for those that don't know about what happened at O'Hare, this is the Chicago O'Hare Airport, in 2006. Tell everybody what happened.
Okay, in November of 2006 is when it occurred, and it was around 4:30 in the afternoon. It was a busy rush hour at O'Hare Airport. And what happened was a number of witnesses on the ground observed, and these were people in the United Airlines mainly, they observed a metallic-looking disc-shaped object hovering over gate C-17 at the United Airlines terminal. And a lot of them, you know, there were pilots on the ground that saw it, there were managers, there were people that were moving planes from one runway to another. It was on the radio, people started talking about it, people were running out and looking at it. And there was also a manager who called the FAA tower and reported it, and we have a copy of that tape, which is a very important part of the evidence of this case. So after this thing was observed for maybe 5 minutes at least, could have been longer, It was hovering right below a cloud bank over the airport. It shot straight up through this cloud bank and cut a very crisp hole in it, just this round hole that was exactly the same shape as the object, and just vanished up above the cloud bank. And that's what actually happened. You know, a number, I'd say maybe 12 to 15 witnesses were interviewed by the Chicago Tribune reporter. And, well documented by the witnesses. Nobody got a photograph of it, although the woman who called the tower to report it said that there had been a photograph taken, but it's never surfaced. But the other interesting thing about this case is not just what actually happened, but the FAA's response to it, which was basically to just dismiss it as a weather phenomenon. And of course, that is not a feasible explanation for what happened that day. So it's typical of how our government responds to cases, and I think it's an important, you know, case for that reason, because it shows that even just within the last few years, the government, our government agencies, are still giving ludicrous explanations for cases, just like they did back in the 50s and 60s under Project Blue Book. Not a whole lot has changed.
One really cool thing about the book is when you mention the explanation of weather phenomenon.
Right.
You know, if my mom, for example, were driving down the road at night and she saw something weird in the air, you know, it'd be like, okay, it's my mom. You know, she just does whatever. But, you know, this is like at O'Hare Airport. And in your book, I mean, you've got pilots here. You know, you've got people that work in the aviation industry. And it's almost insulting. In fact, it is insulting. Some of the explanations for a lot of these things that, you know, you're going to tell somebody who works at the airport every day that this is just a weather phenomenon. You know, they see airplanes, they see craft. These people are pilots. It's just, I don't know.
No, I absolutely agree. It's absolutely infuriating. It is definitely insulting, and these witnesses felt insulted.
Sure.
I mean, these are trained aviation witnesses, and you know, they know what they saw. They described it very clearly, and their government is telling them that they saw something that they didn't see. I mean, that's, you know, it's hard enough for them to speak out about this stuff at all, but to have the government sort of smack them in the face like that and say, we're not even going to take you seriously. We don't, you know, basically the FAA didn't entertain the witness reports as being valid. It just didn't pay attention to them. And yes, it was very, I've talked to witnesses from O'Hare, and they do feel kind of snubbed and insulted by the government authorities that did this. They want answers, and they were also very concerned about the safety aspects of this. I mean, when you have something strange hovering over an airport at rush hour, and you don't know what this thing is, what it's doing there, it's not responding to any communications, and you don't know what it's going to do from one minute to the next, that is a serious safety problem. And even so, the FAA just dismissed it with this ridiculous explanation and never paid it any attention. So that was very puzzling to the witnesses, who say that, you know, most safety issues are addressed by the FAA, but this one, no.
It's very interesting reading the book, too, some of the correspondence that has apparently been made between the United States and other countries. I forget, it might have been the one of the UK flaps, or maybe it was Belgium, mm-hmm. where you know, there's these giant triangular craft, and so you know, the people in Belgium are contacting the US going, you didn't happen to be flying something here? And the response is to the effect of, no, in fact, we haven't, and we've been seeing the same things, and we don't know what they are.
Exactly, that was with the UK, and they basically came back and said, well, we thought maybe these were yours that we're seeing in our country.
Yeah.
And the UK is saying, well, is what we're seeing in our country yours? And they're both asking each other the same question. And this is exactly during the time when the U.S. has told the public that it has no interest in these things anymore.
Sure.
It's not investigating them. There are lots and lots of documents, that correspondence being one of many, that show that our government has taken an interest in this and hasn't, you know, has certainly written up detailed reports of various incidents that have occurred overseas since Project Blue Book, which was the U.S. Air Force project, was shut down in 1970. That's when our government came forward and said, hey, we're not going to investigate UFOs anymore. We don't think they're worthy of it. You know, forget it. Case closed. And yet, over the years, documents have surfaced which indicate that they certainly did continue their investigation in some capacity, but they seem to be more interested in cases overseas than they were in cases in our own country, which of course is very kind of disturbing that the policy seems to be to ignore cases here, but let's write detailed reports about cases that occur elsewhere.
Well, what's interesting is, in a situation like that, the acknowledgement that we have seen these things here and we don't really know what they are, we're wondering if they're yours. I mean, that is an indication that at least at some level of government, whoever is responding to these things has no idea what's going on. But, I mean, to me, I would think that they have to know something because, you know, we've got the 9/11 10-year anniversary here coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And after September 11th, 2001, I mean, the idea that, I mean, it's one thing in 1997 before this all went down. You know, there's something in the sky. We don't know what it is. It doesn't appear to be hostile, but we're not going to scramble any jets or anything like that. But, I mean, anything after 2001, I mean, at O'Hare Airport, there is a mysterious craft in the air. We don't know what it is, and nothing is done about it. I mean, the fact that nothing is done about it suggests to me that they must know, I mean, they must know that there's maybe, you know, there's no threat here. They've seen things like this before, and it's not going to be a threat. It's just weird. You know what I mean? It seems kind of odd that, shouldn't something be done about this post 9/11?
Yeah, you would certainly think that, you know, I agree with you that post 9/11 there would be more concern about the possibility of, say, drones coming in. Because, you know, some of these other countries have developed sort of UFO-looking drones. We have drones that we use over Iraq. So you would think, you know, there might have been some concern, well, is this some kind of spy thing or is this some kind of drone from some other country? And they may have had those concerns, but I think part of the problem was, Brian, that this thing, you know, it disappeared after 5 minutes. And so there was nobody in government that even got to see it, really. I mean, once it's gone, it's gone. And so they just sort of go, huh? We don't know what to make of this. Well, we don't want to acknowledge that it's something unknown because that could disturb people. So I think the policy is just to sort of turn your back on it and not say anything so as not to draw attention to it. Of course, that doesn't work because I think people get so mad about that irresponsible behavior that it actually draws more attention to these things than it might if the government just said, yeah, we've gotten the reports from people and we recognize that something was there, but we don't know what it was. That's it. Our government will not say that. And I think it's important for people to note that, and as I document in the book, other countries do not behave like ours does. Other countries are willing to acknowledge that an unknown object was in the sky and that they can't explain it. And there have not been any panics or collapses of society in any of these other countries in which the government has acknowledged something like this. So our country is especially skittish and kind of paranoid and really neurotic about how it handles these cases in contrast to other countries. And I think we need to take a look at what's going on in other countries. And some of these people from these other governments that, you know, I've actually written chapters in my book, people that have headed up government agencies in the UK, in France, and in other countries where this is handled so differently. And it's very interesting to read, you know, what they've learned from countries that are more interested in investigating these sightings. It's very different.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, it's a very, very difficult question to answer, Brian. And I think, you know, again, we get into speculation here. But I think, you know, I mean, back in the 50s and 60s, of course, we sort of developed the pattern in our country of ridiculing cases really as a means of sort of trying to control the. It's sort of like what Simon has said, people get hysterical about it. You know, the Air Force got so many reports back then, they didn't know what to do with them, they couldn't explain them. They tried to explain away as many cases as they could by offering silly explanations, just because I think they really couldn't explain this stuff, and it was, you know, they didn't know how to manage it all, and they finally just said, I'm sick, you know, we gotta get out of this UFO business. They shut it down, and I think they had clearly established a sort of ridicule tone to it by then that became part of the cultural approach to it and just became sort of, you know, integrated into how the government sees this. And also, there was a CIA panel that was convened in the 1950s that I also write about in the book, in which the CIA scientists actually encouraged our intelligence agencies to debunk UFO cases as a way of controlling the volume of reports. So there was, you know, a serious effort to do this, and I think it's hard to undo something like that without a government actually stepping forward and declaring that they're going to handle it differently now. And our government hasn't done that, and that's one of the things we're proposing in the book, and myself and numerous of these officials that I've been working with, we're hoping that our government will make a change in how it approaches this. But I think that's the only way we're going to undo these years and years of sort of ridiculous, you know, debunking that really has become part of the official approach that we have. And it's just sort of habit, I think.
We'll talk about that coalition here in a moment. I wanted to bring up something in the book that actually, I will admit, it creeped me out. I'd read a lot about the Phoenix Lights for a long time, and you know, you talk in the book about the lack of photographs and the fact that, you know, if you're driving down the road and all of a sudden this thing the size of a football field or larger, you know, there are people that said it was a mile across, mm-hmm. this giant low-flying silent thing goes over your car. I mean, I don't think most people are thinking, where's my camera? You know, they're just looking up at this thing because they've never seen anything like it. They may never see anything like it again, and it's not going to be there for long.
Exactly.
So this is not, you're not thinking, oh my God. So the point I'm making here is when I think about that, and if I thought, okay, if this thing flies over my car, I just think I would be in awe. You know, I don't know if I'd be so much freaked out. I'd just be in awe to see this thing here. In Belgium, however, there's a story in your book about an individual who saw one of these craft, and he decided, I'm going to flash my lights at it. And he flashes his lights at it, and it responds to him.
Doesn't that give you chills?
That
you say, creep me out. With me,
scare the hell out of me.
Chills.
Scare the hell out of me.
Yeah, and, you know, the interesting thing is, Brian, that happened also in the Hudson Valley wave, which is sort of the parallel wave that I draw. I make the comparison between in the book between that and Belgium. The Hudson Valley wave occurred here in New York State in the mid-1980s, I'm sorry. You know, just a few years before the Belgian wave, the same thing happened there. There were people who flashed car lights at the objects, and it would respond by flashing back. Now, that really, to me, too, is one of the most chilling and intense and almost disturbing aspects of the whole phenomenon is when you actually get that kind of communication and you don't know who the hell is doing that.
No,
it's
looking at you at that point.
Yeah,
it's not just like I'm looking at you, but you're just a big craft in the air. Now it's responding to you.
Right. And the people who flashed their lights also reported that it was a couple, that they were driving along this very windy, hilly road and the craft followed them up and down. It kept it sort of the same distance from them the whole time. And then they were getting really frightened by it eventually. They drove along for a while, and this thing just followed them along after having had this light interchange, you know. And eventually it went off, but they were frightened by it. And I can understand why, really.
Yeah, I have a friend, actually, that it's not a UFO story, but he was driving, and he tried to pass a semi, and the semi wasn't happy with that, and the semi followed him, you know, very close for miles and miles.
Oh,
he was panicked, and I just thought, this is a semi, and there's a human in there, and most likely he's not going to kill you, but, you know, he's just kind of threatening, a little threatening.
Yeah, that's scary.
I mean, an alien or whatever the thing is, you know, something like that, you know, in the air that you don't know what it is, and it has responded to you, and it's chasing you. You know, that's heart attack city right there, in my opinion.
No, Brian, I hope it never happens to you.
Now, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but the book is like, here's the facts. You know, here's what happened. Here is the opinion of the people that witnessed these things. I want to know a little bit about Leslie Keene. I don't know how much you want to talk about your own personal belief and that sort of thing, but you mentioned the ET hypothesis earlier, and in some of these cases, people came to the conclusion that this is the most likely scenario. In your opinion, from covering this for so long, what do you believe?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I think I just sort of pretty much take the position that these French generals took back. You know, I mean, it hasn't changed a whole lot from when I first read that report back in 1999, when they stated that it is a very logical and rational hypothesis, and it needs to be considered, the ET hypothesis, along with any other explanation that we can offer for these things. And, you know, it's very hard when you've studied case after case after case that is as documented as well as these cases are. And I've spoken to so many, you know, very credible people on this. It's hard to come up with other possible explanations that make any more sense than the extraterrestrial one. So I'm not willing to say that I know what they are by any stretch of the imagination, because I don't think any of us know what they are. But I think, you know, I certainly agree with these high-level officials who have said that this hypothesis is rational and needs to be considered and taken very seriously. And it's quite possible that these are visitors from, you know, some other planet or something. I mean, you just don't have the option of writing off that possibility once you take a hard, serious look at the data. You just don't have that choice. That's the bottom line. There aren't too many ways of explaining it, unless you want to just do what in this recent person from the Smithsonian who just, you know, reviewed my book. I mean, I was just so stunned. He said there is absolutely no physical evidence for the phenomenon. Therefore, his assumption is that this is sort of like ghosts and fairies. It's just sort of like a cultural belief that we have because we're all, you know, our planet is in trouble and we've got all these bad things happening and we want to look for something bigger than us that might save us from, you know, ecological destruction and economic collapse and all the things that we're dealing with. So, but he made the statement that there is no physical evidence for these, and I was just stunned. I just felt like, did you read the book? You know, so you can draw that kind of conclusion, that you're just not going to accept that any of these cases represent anything anomalous. And that's up to the reader to decide, you know, when you look at the cases and you hear what these people have to say. But if you're not going to do that, if you're not going to just sort of write them all off that way, you're not stuck. You don't have a lot of options to choose from. That's the bottom line. And so the ET hypothesis definitely has to be in the mix there, and very strongly in the mix. And that's why we propose in our book, that in my book, I mean, I propose that scientists get a lot more involved with this than they've been, that scientists should be, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they should be curious about this. They should want to find out more. You know, perhaps there's all kinds of technology we can learn from these phenomena. Or, you know, we might discover what they are if we just put our minds to it. So I'm hoping that someday we will find out what they are, and that the scientists are I think they're the ones that have to get on board, and they're the ones that have to make that discovery, and I hope it happens.
Probably a strange question, and I've just always kind of, you know, I'm a skeptical person. I don't mm-hmm. know how you could read your book and not come to the conclusion that these are anomalous phenomenon, whatever they are. I mean, it's virtually impossible to read that book and come to that conclusion. But one thing that in a lot of the sightings that comes up all over the world is something that's always just kind of, I don't know if it's bothered me, but it's just something that I've always wondered about. It always, these craft always have lights, and they always have, they often, you'll hear about a searchlight. You know, there are a couple of reports of, you know, this craft is you know, floating over a field, and there's a searchlight that appears to be looking for something. And it's always just been so weird to me because, you know, you read about these reports, they're so big, they're so quiet, sometimes they move at 90-degree angles, they take off at, you know, in a split second. It's all of these things that just, we don't have this technology. You know, at the same time, they've just got lights on them. It's always just been something that's been really strange to me. I don't know if you've ever talked to anybody about
or... I understand what you're saying. I mean, it seems almost primitive that why would they have their lights on? I think you have to realize, first of all, that there are lots of daylight sightings in which lights are not on.
Sure.
So we do have, you know, we have photographs of some extraordinary daylight sightings of UFOs where, you know, obviously they're not lit up. Second of all, we don't know how many of them may be flying around at night without lights that we don't see because they don't have lights.
Sure.
So we don't know. I mean, maybe there are more without lights than there are with lights, and the ones that have the lights have it for some kind of purpose. But I think it's a very interesting point. I mean, if they're not, it makes sense to me that if they're searching for something, they might have a light that they beam down. But some of them just have lights on them irrespective of the beaming down factor. You know, just they might have just a row of lights like the craft that did over Phoenix, for instance. And you could ask, why would these very advanced ships, why would they need these lights? If this is indeed what they are, I mean, you know, if they are some physical craft from somewhere else, are they trying to make themselves known, perhaps? Or, you know, why would they need the lights on them? I mean, I think it's a fascinating question, and I don't think we know the answer. You know, there's so many why questions about the behaviors of these objects, and one of them being the lights and the variety, the incredible variety that we've observed. I mean, it's all part of the mystery. We don't know what they're doing, why they're doing it, what their purpose is. Why there's, you know, those why questions we just don't have answers for. All we can do is kind of try to figure it out as best we can by through speculation. But I think the question of the lights is a very interesting one. I agree with you. It seems bizarre, you know, but we just don't know what we're not seeing also.
Was there one particular story when you put the book together that to you just sort of stood out head and shoulders above the others? Or, I mean, maybe it was the one you found most fascinating, or the most interesting witness, or was there anything that, was there anything that really stood out, or are they just kind of all of them are equally fascinating
to you?
It's
a good question. I mean, they're all fascinating. I mean, I was very fascinated by both the Belgian Wave and the Hudson Valley Wave in the United States, just because the craft were observed by so many different people over a long period of time, so there was so much data. You know, it wasn't just a one-time event. And I think those cases are really interesting for that reason. I also think the two cases that are in the book in which these two pilots actually attempted to shoot down a UFO
mm-hmm.
are really fascinating. And those chapters were, I mean, both the stories, both one from an Iranian pilot and another one from a Peruvian pilot, both Air Force pilots, have written their own chapters about what it was like for them to be sent up and told to shoot down. Actually, that's not true. One of them was told to just get a closer look at it in Iran, but the second one in Peru was actually instructed to shoot the thing down. And it's just fascinating to read about what happened when they tried to shoot them down, what they were feeling, what they were thinking, what they saw when they got close to the object, how the object behaved when they were when these pilots were acting, exhibiting aggressive behavior towards them. I think those stories are really exciting and really fascinating, and you almost feel like you're reading a science fiction story, but you're not, because both of those cases were completely documented by the U.S. government itself. I mean, they took the trouble to go and interview people in those countries about what actually happened in both those incidents, and they're well documented in government documents. Plus, they had so many witnesses to them, and so much, you know, there's so much corroboration as to what happened during those events that we know that they actually happened as they are described. So I think it's just fascinating to read those chapters and to hear directly from those pilots, you know, what it was like for them to engage these objects in this way. Very unusual, because there aren't that many cases we have on the record, you know, where pilots report having actually attempted to shoot at them. So these are really, really exciting stories to read.
I heard about your History Channel special after it aired, of course.
Okay, well, hopefully you'll get a chance to see it, because I know they'll repeat it.
Yeah, it's
I don't know when.
I believe replayed twice so far.
Yeah, replayed again. It was on last weekend, on Saturday night, September 3rd, and it's called Secret Access UFOs on the Record. And, I worked closely with the film, an independent film company named Breakthrough Films, who was commissioned by History Channel to produce this based on cases in my book. So I was actively involved as a producer on the show, working with the filmmakers, and a superb group of a team of filmmakers that made the film. They had their award-winning, you know, documentary feature filmmakers. So it was really, they did a fantastic job. And The documentary just, you know, explores a number of the cases that I presented in the book, and I think they did a really, really good job of bringing them to life. We traveled in Europe to document, you know, a number of the cases there, and it did very well. So I hope that listeners who haven't had a chance to see it will figure out when it's going to be on again and get a chance to see it. I can let you know it is, at least as of a couple of weeks ago, it was on YouTube. Whether it's still there or not, I don't know, and I would always prefer people to watch it on TV if they can, because I think the quality of the YouTube broadcast is not nearly as good as it is when you actually see it on TV. But it may still be there for people that aren't going to be able to watch the History Channel and want to get a look at it anyway. You could search a YouTube for it.
Now, was there any new information that you discovered when you were traveling around to recreate, maybe not so much recreate, but further investigate these cases?
I'm trying to think. There was a few new things that were brought forward in the film. Most of it, though, was, you know, interviewing the people involved with the cases and kind of bringing to life what was in the book.
Sure.
So there was one new tape we aired in connection with the Phoenix Lights case, which we've been talking about, of a pilot from Luke Air Force Base, or I think not a pilot. I don't think he's a pilot, but he was a serviceman at I forget what his actual status was at Luke Air Force Base, who called in that night and reported that there had been jets scrambled after an object, and we have the tape of him. It's, you know, he's not on the record, so I was a little bit hesitant to use it, but the producers of the show wanted to use that, so that's kind of interesting. And Fife Symington really comes forward very well in the documentary, I think, as well. So I can't think of any other, you know, I think really it was just kind of bringing to life these very, very significant cases and making the same point that I make in the book, which is that government officials and pilots and generals and high-level people around the world take the subject very seriously, and it is worthy of serious consideration by scientists and government officials, and that's sort of the point we're making by focusing on bringing forward, you know, a NASA scientist or a former UK defense official who was head of the agency in the UK. We've got the major general from Belgium talking about the Belgium wave. Very, very high-level people bringing forward these cases, and I think it gives it, you know, it gives it a certain serious quality that really makes you stop and think when you see it.
Well, before we go, I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the Coalition for Freedom of Information. You write about it in the book. There's a website as well, freedomofinfo.org. So tell everybody a little bit about it.
Okay, well, that's sort of when I got started in this subject back in, you know, as I mentioned, I wrote the Boston Globe story in 2000. I wrote a second story in 2001 about aviation safety issues around UFO sightings and pilot sightings. And I was approached around that time by the Sci-Fi Channel, which was a cable channel based in New York, and they were launching a Freedom of Information Act initiative to try to get to the bottom of a UFO case. And try to get information from the government that had not been released before. And I was invited to sort of spearhead this effort as a journalist, you know, to be the sort of public figure who would bring it forward. And we investigated the Kecksburg UFO case. It was a crash that took place in 1965, and we spent years and years and years and eventually ended up filing a lawsuit against NASA and going to court to try to get documents on this case. And it was at the beginning of that initiative that we formed a group called the Coalition for Freedom of Information, which was really the people who were involved with this Freedom of Information Act initiative to try and get. It was a whole team of professionals. And we were, you know, we just sort of set out a mission to try and bring greater credibility to the UFO subject and to try to increase the seriousness that the media takes it and, you know, bring a certain level of sophistication to it that we felt was lacking. And the coalition has really been sort of a support network for the work that I've done as sort of the public face of that organization. And, you know, I've been fortunate to have many outstanding advisors and people that have sort of jumped on board and been willing to help the effort move forward. So it's basically a very loose affiliation of volunteers who have been invited to kind of help, take the same approach that I do and have helped me with my work over the years. One of the things we did in 2007, we helped James Fox, who's a filmmaker. I co-organized a press conference in Washington, D.C. with him in November of 2007, in which we invited about 13, 14 people from around the world to come and get me speak at this press conference. And a number of the people that did that were ended up writing chapters for my book, and for some of them it was the first time I actually met them was at that press conference. And we are the Coalition for Freedom of Information issued a petition, a kind of a document at that press event stating that we would like the U.S. government to set up an office to investigate UFOs, so to kind of change its policy. And that was sort of the coalition put out this document with signatures from very high-level people around the world. So that's the kind of thing we've been doing over the years. And since the 2007 press conference, of course, I've been focused on writing this book and then getting it out. And I've kind of been, you know, but the coalition, a number of the people who wrote chapters in my book are part of the what I call the Coalition for Freedom of Information. So I hope that explains it. It's a very kind of loose affiliation of people, basically, with a similar goal.
And James Fox did the documentary on the Phoenix Lights.
Exactly. He did a documentary actually called I Know What I Saw, which was based on the press conference that he and I organized in 2007, and it did cover the Phoenix Lights. You're absolutely right. He was the person, actually, who first got Fife Symington to admit that he was a witness to this case himself. And it was James who went to interview him for his film, not knowing, you know, what to expect. He just thought, well, I'm going to go ask the governor why he did that silly press conference that he did and what he thinks about it today. And James had no idea that the governor was going to look at his camera in that interview and come out and state that he actually saw the object himself. I mean, it was an amazing moment. And he was the first person that, you know, Fife spoke to about it, Fife Symington. So that was a big moment and a big part of the film that he produced.
There's actually a great story on that in the book as well for everybody. Just the story of sitting down to interview him, and Fife Symington admits that, I drove out and I saw it, and, you know, James is just like, I'm just going to make sure the camera's running.
His drawer just dropped open, and tell the whole story of how that happened in the book, and it's very entertaining to read it. And then what James did was he actually, you know, and we kept it, he kept it under wraps for quite a while, and then when the 10th anniversary of Phoenix Lights rolled around, he actually granted me permission to do the first print story on this breaking news, because his movie wasn't ready yet, and we thought the 10th anniversary was the time in which we should break the story of Fife Symington's acknowledgement of having been a witness to this. So I was fortunate enough to be introduced to him by James, and I broke the story in an Arizona newspaper. And, of course, the national media went nuts for it after that, and my little story got kind of lost in the shuffle there when all the national media tried to get Fife Symington to come on their shows, and CNN did a piece on it, et cetera. But it was a big moment for me to be in the position of being able to break that story. It was really exciting.
The book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record, is a New York Times bestseller. It's available all over the place, Amazon.com. The paperback is now out as well. You can get it on your Kindle. I've got it on the Kindle here. It's an excellent book. The website, UFOsOnTheRecord.com. If you're more if you're interested on the Coalition for Freedom of Information, that's freedomofinfo.org. And Leslie is up on Facebook, Facebook.com/LeslieKane. That's K-E-A-N, Leslie Kane. So you can check that out as well. And Leslie, thanks again very much for doing the show today. It was awesome. And best of luck with the book and everything you do.
Well, Brian, thanks so much. I really appreciated talking with you. And, I appreciate your interest in the subject. And thanks a lot for having me on.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. We shall talk to you again after a while.